Well, hey there, and welcome to Endeavors. Hello, and welcome back to Endeavors 2.0. On the show today, Canadian singing icons Sharon and Bram, as well as author, essayist, and academic Anne Giardini, and the music of Royal Wood. That's all coming up on today's show.
There are two of us sinking. I won't let you drown.
My first guests got their start nearly 40 years ago with their album One Elephant, Deux Elephants. Years later, after two TV shows and an Order of Canada, they are still going strong. They are lions in the world of children's music. They are Sharon Hampson and Bran Morrison, and I got to speak with them a few weeks ago. Well, welcome to Vancouver, or welcome back, I should say. Sharon was telling me before interview that Vancouver holds a bit of a special memory for you guys, and that it was your first concert as a group outside of Toronto.
Well, outside of Ontario.
Outside of Ontario, yes.
Yeah, when we came to the Vancouver Children's Fest, our first record, One Elephant, Deux Elephants, came out in 1978 in the fall, and we were invited to come to the Vancouver Children's Festival in the spring of 1979. That was very exciting. That was one first. And the other?
The other was our first appearance ever anywhere with a symphony orchestra, and it was the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra at the Orpheum Theatre.
It's hard to imagine that the first record came out almost 40 years ago. I mean, many, many bands, many groups don't last half that lifespan. What do you attribute that longevity to?
That's a very interesting question.
Actually, I'm the son of Mick Jagger.
I think we've managed to, you know, to be together. I think when most bands break up, it's because of personal relationship troubles, and was not a problem for us. I think, you know, we were all adults when we started. We all were married and had families, and so we understood the give and take of relationships, and I think that served us as well in our business relationship, which is not to say we didn't have issues or problems, but we managed to make our way through them. And also, we shared fundamental values about the kind of music that we wanted to make and the way we wanted to do it. And it had to do with valuing children and believing that they deserve the best that's possible, and using those values in the way we approached it with musicians and arrangers and all of that.
You know, it's interesting because I feel that you guys at least got your start at a time when children's music seem to be on the rise. They don't seem to have those types of what do you make of the type of music or the type of entertainment that's marketed towards children today versus maybe when you started out?
It seems to be a lot shallower these days. They're not as interested in the music. A lot of the people and groups out there seem to think that it's required that if you're doing music for children, you've got to be teaching them something. And we never took that approach. We made music, choosing songs, arranging them, singing them, because it was music and songs that we liked. We always knew that there was learning taking place, but that wasn't number one on the list. That was a side issue. I have a funny memory from one of those early children's festivals. It may have been right here in Vancouver in that first year that we were here, a year or two afterwards. There was a van, it was full of Sharon, Lois and Bran, Raffi, Fred Penner, and Eric Nagler.
What about Al? Was Al in there too?
I don't think so.
Al Simmons, he's also terrific.
And somebody said, it may have been Fred or Eric, I don't remember who said it, if this car drives off this bridge that we're on right now, that's the end of Canadian children's music.
Happily, that didn't happen.
You know, you mentioned your two TV shows there. What was that like for you translating your brand of music into a wider audience, a wider medium? Was it a difficult adjustment at first?
Well, it was a serious learning curve. Serious. And we loved it. But one of the first directors that we had in television, Stan Swan, he taught us very effectively. When you play in a theater, like we're playing in the Orpheum or other theaters, you project to the back row. He said to us, when you're talking television, when you're singing or talking, you are playing to one person in the front row. And when we didn't get it right, he'd say, "You're playing to Australia." So we learned about projection and being direct.
The intimacy of television.
Yeah, and we loved it.
But you don't make television by yourself. Television is done by a team of
large
producers
and
craftspeople of all kinds, writers,
directors,
and you're surrounded by a talented crew of people in all of those different areas that you need, and you learn to become a team player.
You know, speaking of television, Sharon and I were talking a little bit before the interview about cell phones and technology. Google Maps, I think, is what we were mentioning.
Right.
And, you know, I'm curious, you know, with sort of the, everyone these days has at least one cell phone and at least one computer. And I know I've noticed when I go to shows, you know, whether it's at a nightclub or even a place like the Orpheum, people are constantly on their phones and trying to watch the show through technology. And I'm curious, you know, as performers, what your relationship with technology is like. Has it made it easier to be a performer? Has it made it harder?
Well, what you have just described does not happen on our shows, because our shows are very physical. You know, people are doing actions, they're standing up and sitting down and moving their arms and their legs, so they're not busy with technology. Except after the show, when we sign autographs, we take a lot of pictures. And on occasion, in the past, where we've done pub shows at universities, which we have loved to do, after the first couple of songs, I have asked, "How many of you have phoned your mothers?" And all the hands go up in the air, because they take pictures of us, they send them to their parents, because people who are listening to us listened to us when they were younger with their families.
And, you know, we've done concerts for the current crop of people who are our kids back in those earlier generations. And, well, we did a festival in Toronto last summer called Field Trip. Now, on the main stage...
It's an indie festival.
An
real
indie festival. And we had, I don't know, 1,000 people or
at
more.
At least. A huge audience.
And
lovely.
They were all 20 and 30-something.
There were no children in
the
audience.
And they were doing Peanut, Peanut Butter, and all of those action songs and singing along. It's their nostalgia.
Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary.
It's quite lovely, actually. And, you know, sometimes we meet adults who grew up on us, and they get a little bit weepy, especially the women, but sometimes the men. And, you know, when it first happened, I remember that a woman was waiting on the street after we'd done an early morning TV interview, and she was waiting for us, and she got kind of weepy, and she was embarrassed. And I said, "Don't be embarrassed. You know, you're remembering happy times with your family. That's a good thing."
Do you have to pinch yourself every now and then saying, you know, hey, these people that we performed for 25, 30 years ago are still with us today and didn't sort of move on with the times, so to speak.
Well, they may have moved on, but they kept us.
Yeah, and yes, yeah. It's a great pleasure. It's a great thrill. And it's generational as well. So the grandparents and the parents and the little children are sharing the music, and that's as good as it gets for you.
How different is the vibe for you performing, you know, for all adults or all young adults versus sort of very young children?
It's interesting. I mean, it doesn't happen very often. The Field Trip experience that Bram mentioned is kind of a rare opportunity.
A one-off kind of thing.
But recently we've noticed that a lot of people who grew up on us come to the concerts, and they bring their very young children who probably they wouldn't bring if the parents didn't have the history with us. So it's quite lovely. I mean, the little ones...
They don't know us.
They don't know us.
Because we're not on television anymore.
And they're, you know, it's not as significant to them. Hopefully the music reaches them and they carry it away with some memories. But it's very lovely to see how the parents feel about it.
We've heard people saying, I've hung on to my turntable because I haven't wanted to give up your LPs, and I play them for my kids.
And we say, hold on to them, because they're coming back.
That's true. What do you, you know, given, you know, all the easy, accessible ways we have music now, like on your computer, what do you make of the fact that sort of vinyl is on the rise again?
I find it astounding, actually, but I think,
well,
it's lovely.
There are aficionados, audio people, who say that if you really... are a careful listener, that the sound quality from an LP is better than digital. Analog beats digital.
And you know, in addition, for us, when our albums were out on LP, and there, you know, we had a big album and big picture of us on the cover, kids would walk around holding the album cover because they could relate to those people. And then we went to cassette, which
teensy,
is, you know,
weensy.
I mean, how does a kid connect with a visual on something so small?
Then things got a little bit bigger with CDs.
With CDs, yeah. But
we
albums,
love the album covers.
Yeah, love it. People still come to the concerts occasionally with their album covers for us to autograph, which is lovely.
You know, I think every band has probably one or two iconic songs. And when I think of Sharon, Lois, and Bram, I think of Skinnarinky.
Yeah,
sure.
Of course.
Why do you think it was that song in particular that connected with so many people and has sort of defined you guys, for lack of a better term?
We chose that song from, you know, among many others, to end our first concerts. We've learned it from Lois, who learned it from a young cousin in Chicago. We put it on the first record, which came before we ever did any live performing. We had never performed together.
We'd never sung together before we made the record, the first record.
Wow.
It's very unusual.
And I didn't even sing on that original version. Lois sang it, Sharon sang harmony, and I played the ukulele part on my guitar. But we thought, what a nice way to end the concert. And so we did. And we never ended anything
Ever after
that with anything different.
So partly it's the exposure. Every television show ended with that. Every concert we ever did ended with that. So, and we included it on almost every record, if not every. And in addition, it's simple, and it's a direct love song that families sing to each other. So I think it had the exposure, but it also had the content that really resonated with people. And it's a sweet, simple message. A sweet, simple melody. It just clicked.
And of course, for some reason, the other image I always associate with you guys is the elephant.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
You know, one elephant is elephant, and then the elephant show with Eric. Do you remember if there was a reason behind why you guys chose that animal as your counterpart, so to speak?
It was from the song. One elephant went out to play upon a spider's web one day, which we found a French version of as well. And so we did it on that first recording.
Which we called by that name.
One Elephant is Elephant. We included that in our first concert as well. And we borrowed an elephant costume from a production of Babar that was going on with the Toronto Dance Theatre at that time. And we had an elephant come and dance on during that show on that song, and
probably on Skinnarink as well.
Yeah,
the end, probably.
And
it was
that,
a friend
that sent that set the, a pattern, and then we used that costume for a few years. But then when we started doing elephant show, a whole new one was designed, and that became the sort of the model.
Yeah, the iconic elephant.
Yeah, from the elephant show, and then Skinnarink TV had a different elephant, which spoke and sang. The first one was mute and neuter, gender.
Sometimes male, sometimes female. Would be very contemporary.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's another thing I was going to ask about, because you were sort of talking about the exposure to pop culture, and, you know, how much of what you see, what you experience, and how much of what your fans are exposed to, how different is it now than it was, you know, 30, 35 years ago when you guys were first starting out?
Well, it just brought a very funny memory to my mind. I remember at one point early on, some kid said, "Is Elephant a boy or a girl?" And I happened to be the one who answered. And I said, "We don't know." And that is so today.
Yes, it is. That's funny. The thing about how people respond today as compared to 30 years ago is exactly the same. When we get on the stage and we start singing, they do almost exactly the same thing. The one thing that I noticed that is different is that when we were doing Elephant Show, we did a big concert which was divided into components that were used in each Elephant Show. If we said stand up, everybody stood up. Now when we say stand up, not all the adults stand up. But they did in the early days. I don't know why. Do you have?
Because they're older and it's harder for them.
Oh, please. We're older and it's not harder for
yes,
us.
Yes, it is.
Oh, well, for you. Yeah, no, I don't know. It's really interesting. I mean, lots of them get up and do it. And the thing is, they should, because they're modeling for their children. They're doing it together with their children. when you separate yourself from your children by your behavior at a concert like that, it's unfortunate. So mostly people do, but not everybody in the way they did in the good old days.
You mentioned earlier about how you weren't necessarily saying that your songs were going to be, you know, of the educational
right.
variety.
For sure.
But there's always a debate about education, specifically when it comes to children. You know, I know just being exposed to the scene in Vancouver, you hear a lot of like, well, you know, there's this policy, more like there's the general nudity policy and anti-bullying policy and all this.
Exactly. And there are people writing songs about all that stuff, and we don't do any of that.
But, you know, what are your thoughts on the state of education today as it pertains to children?
Oh, boy, that's a monstrously large question.
Yes, exactly.
And it varies greatly from one jurisdiction to another.
Right. And we're not in that arena.
We're not experts on that.
No.
Honestly.
Exactly.
But we do know that there's a terrible lack of arts education across the board.
Yeah,
when things get cut, guess what gets
the
cut
arts.
First?
Exactly.
Sure.
And it's a terrible mistake because along with the pleasure that people get from doing it and exploring their own creativity, there's also a lot of learning that goes along with it that's being bypassed, and which is it's all unfortunate. The other thing that I think is unfortunate, and it has to do with the way children are scheduled. Are we still recording?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It has to do with the way children are scheduled, which is, in my opinion, and probably Bram's as well, too much. The opportunity for free play and creative play and finding your way and having new experiences and all of that doesn't exist very much. There's a lot of structure. You go to this lesson and that play date and this lesson and these too much of that. And in my opinion, I think that's unfortunate. I think that children miss a lot of opportunities to find their way, to find their creativity.
You know, I remember as I was growing up, I lived in a part of Toronto that had, within very close walking distance, some very natural wooded areas, right in the heart of Toronto. And my friends and I, we used to go and play in the forest for the day.
Yeah.
And that's unheard of now.
People are very nervous about letting their kids be independent you know, if you look at the statistics, it's no less safe now than it was then. It's just that there's a lot more media and sharing of information now.
You guys reached true Canadian icon status when you guys received the Order of Canada.
Oh boy, was that a thrill!
Just talk to us about like that process. Like, what was going through your mind when you're up there receiving this?
I think the most powerful thing for me, besides the fact that we were being honored, which was a real thrill, was to look around the room and see all the other people in that cadre that were being presented. And when they read their brief bios and what their accomplishments were, as each one was called up individually, or reading it in the program, I said to myself, oh my goodness, there's so many people doing fantastic things in this country
that nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah. It's not just public figures like us and Leonard Cohen and, you know, other public figures. There are people who have been working at their... There was a woman there at our table at the banquet. She was an Inuit woman. She didn't speak anything but Inuktitut. She didn't speak English. She didn't speak French. She'd spent her life gathering folk tales from her culture and compiling an Inuktitut dictionary. And her daughter was there as her interpreter. I'd never heard of that woman before in my life, but the committee thought, this woman is doing something really valuable and being recognized for it, and I was sitting beside her. And
yeah,
that was a thrill.
You know, I'll tell you a cute story. We didn't know that we were nominated. That was a complete surprise. And you get the letter saying that you've been nominated as a member of the Order of Canada and that you cannot tell anyone. And we had both gotten our letters and speaking to Lois on the phone, but not... I mean, we could have told her, but I wanted to surprise for her to have the same... Open the envelope and be surprised. And she said, I think we called her. My daughter was with me. And she said, I got something. I have to go pick it up at the post office. But I, you know, and my daughter said, Lois, I'm coming. I'll take you right now. So she could find out.
Was it a registered letter?
I think so, yeah. It was very cute.
Well, it's interesting because Lois is the only non-Canadian in the group. She's American, born American, raised and educated, and never gave up her U.S. citizenship and never took Canadian citizenship.
Right.
So her Order of Canada was honorary.
Yeah, it was a different category.
Is the same.
Oh, yeah. And they only give out a limited number in that category. So,
is that right?
Yeah. Anyway, everything about it was thrilling, absolutely thrilling.
And
such an honor.
And the fact that it was Adrian Clarkson, who was the
presenter,
was the Governor General at that time, whom we had known before from being around CBC Toronto and crossing paths, and so it was very comforting that we got it from her,
someone we knew. Yeah, it's lovely. She said, as she was pinning them on us, she said, the last time we were together, I think, was in a makeup room at CBC.
what do you think you guys will want your legacy to be, you know, as the generations remember you?
Well, hopefully people will remember families singing together that they did when they were younger and as I got older. And if there's some continuation of that behavior, that would be a great legacy. And also, of course, if they keep singing Skin and Rink to each other, then that will be perfect.
But we're very fortunate that we are doing this in a time where you can preserve all of this, all of this repertoire, our singing on physical recordings or electronic recordings or in the cloud or wherever that it can. I mean, wouldn't I have loved to have heard Paganini play the violin?
Directly. Yeah.
And
not heard about it, but heard it.
Yeah. And we're very lucky in that respect that we're there in archives for people to consult generations from now.
Well, Sharon, Bram, this has been a huge pleasure for me. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Dan.
That was my conversation with Sharon and Bram. And now here is Royal Wood with I'm Gonna Marry You.
It's like we're in the deepest ocean, and our own starry sky. The moon was a spotlight, phosphorescent glow in our eyes. This should come as no surprise then, baby, hey, hey, that I'm gonna marry you. It's like we're in a holy desert, your own blazing sky. Sun up, there's a torch, babe, to the glory of our love in our eyes. This should come as no surprise then, baby, hey, hey, that I'm gonna marry you. Well, I'm so drunk on you, my baby, hey, intoxicated all the time. Well, I'm so drunk on
chance to speak with Royal a little while ago about his new album, Ghost Light. What can you tell us about how this album, this project, sort of came to be for you?
Well, it was very much one of those serendipitous, you know, feeling like you're on the path and something's guiding you. I was in Los Angeles and I was doing some writing and production for some other people, and wasn't really intending on making a record yet. It hadn't been that long since I put out The Burning Bright, which came out right before it, as well as a couple other things. So, but I was in the studio with some days to kill, and ended up demoing, I thought was going to be demoing some songs. And after day three of demoing them, with this guy named Bill Leffler, him and I ended up producing all of the Ghost Light together, because it just flowed so easily, and I just, you know, I jumped around from instrument to instrument, and Bill played drums and a few other things, and it just had that organic, natural feel, you know? There wasn't pre-production, there was no A&R guy saying, you know, what's the single? It just was. It was just kind of me as truly a creator and kid in the candy store, just doing what I love to do. And I think that's why the record is as jubilant and boyous as it is.
You know, a lot of musicians, a lot of bands, you know, can take upwards of 5-6 years to put out albums. You've released quite a few in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years here. Is it because that writing songs comes really easy to you, or is it just more that you have something to say, so you want to say it sooner rather than later?
Well, I'm not sure, and I'm not sure which comes first. I mean, I'm always writing. There's always something sort of percolating, and I capture it as much as I can. But I feel it's kind of like that Leonard Cohen quote I read years ago when I was a kid. It's like, if I knew where the songs came from, I'd go there more often. And I'm not exactly sure where things come from, and I know one day that tap can turn off. So I think I'm just enjoying the flow for as long as this thing goes.
How would you describe your writing process then? Do you always tend to come up with lyrics first and then put them to music, or do you hear the melody before?
Well, the good ones for me tend to happen all at the same time. So there's no was not me sitting down and sketching out what I think could be a song or should be a song. And I'm certainly not thinking today I'll write, you know, a song about love, and today I'm going to write X, Y, Z. I have an instrument, and just something ends up feeling like it needs to exist, you know, and you're just kind of there to capture it. And sometimes it's lightning in a bottle, and other times it's a arduous long process. And the ones where it feels arduous and I'm really kind of pulling stuff out, those are the songs I throw away and I never do anything with, because I feel like they didn't really deserve to be brought into life. So I just try to capture it really, really and truly as much as I can.
You are known for playing several different instruments, guitar, bass, drums, trumpet, among others. Does that make the production of an album for you easier or harder, the fact that you can do a lot of it yourself?
It certainly doesn't make it harder or easier for that matter. I think it's just it's a different process and a different evolution each time I make a record. And when I first started, I was kind of doing everything. I mean, I was playing all the instruments, and I was producing and mixing and arranging and just the captain in his captain's chair. And then you start to evolve as an artist, and you let more people into your world. And it's funny, as an artist, it happens as if something's happening in your life, it translates into your art, because I let more people into my life. And as a result, I had more people really in on the process of making a record. So I did a few there where it was myself and my band and really live off the floor and trying to capture something that was uniquely not me, you know, because if it's just me playing everything, then I think I have certain things that I would do naturally as an artist. And you can get the exact same song with the exact same part to a different person, and the nuances of them are going to come through differently. So there is something to be said for playing with other musicians, and I still like to have a few colors on a record. This last one, though, I did a lot of it myself. There's certain things I wanted someone else's vibe and someone else's feel. So, like the horns, for instance, on this record, I had this guy named Bryden Baird, who I've played with for years, and he used to be my horn player and toured with me. I asked him to arrange the horn parts on a few of the songs, because he's just going to do something innately different than me, and I wanted something different. So you just have to know in that moment what you're kind of going for, I think.
And you also grew up in a musical household. So do you think it was evident for you pretty early on that this was the direction you were going to go with your life?
Yeah. I mean, I started playing piano when I was 4, and other instruments followed pretty quickly. And I think some kids grab a hockey stick. Some kids, you know, want to bury their nose in a book. And I just wanted to have an instrument in my hand, and I wanted to create a song. So it was definitely a vocation. It was just something that brought immense joy, and something that came, I don't want to say just easily, but it's something that just naturally I wanted to do. I naturally wanted to do. No one said, you have to take piano lessons. I wanted to take lessons. No one said, you have to take music in school. I wanted to. And no one said, you have to ignore your friends all summer long and just sit in your room and try to learn as much as you can about music. That's just what I did as a kid. So you tend to do, when you're left to your own devices, what your true passion is. And mine was definitely music.
Now, I know that your great-grandfather was an amateur musician, and you were named after him. And I'm curious, is how does that affect you, maybe both personally and creatively, the fact that you're almost representing this man?
Well, to be honest, I haven't really thought about it that way. Music surrounded me as a kid, and I had 3 older brothers and a younger sister, and my parents. Like, music was just something that was such a guiding force in our life and in that house. And, you know, there's so many memories of us all sitting around the kitchen table with guitars and banjo and harmonica and someone playing spoons, and like just songs, you know, songs happening and around the campfire, and family members and friends would come over, and my parents would ask me to play the piano and do something, you know. It was always there, and it always just felt right. So I never thought for an instant that I should be or shouldn't be based on any sort of lineage. It was just what was.
I'm also very curious about the time you spent in Ireland, which I know was a big part of your previous album, The Burning Break, because I can definitely hear in a lot of your music that sort of faint, you know, husky storytelling that is so prevalent in, among Irish music. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I mean, I spent a lot of time touring in other places and in other countries, and Ireland has definitely always felt like home. And most of my ancestry is Irish, and I grew up listening to stories from my grandmother about life in Ireland and you know, living amongst the horses and delivering ice and all kinds of sort of rural village Irish history. And I don't know, we're steeped in that, you know, like we're tea that's been sitting in a pot for a while, ready to be poured, and just good Irish people. And so that's definitely a part of me. And being there, especially when I went and lived there for a long time and sort of gave up my life here, and there's no phone and no TV and no internet. And I had this little cottage in basically the middle of a farmer's field, and you know, the nearest village was 6-7 kilometers away. And even that village was only two streets. So it was called Slane, and in the county Meath. And being out there just felt like I was back home at the farm that I grew up on. So it's just another part of me, you know, it's just another color. But obviously we're such multifaceted, multi-layered, multi-dimensional beings, and as much as that is a part of my music and a part of what I do, then I'm also very much I'm a Canadian, and I have the culture of Canada, and I grew up in the heyday of Canada, long before we started to lose our standing in a few areas in the world. You know, I grew up in the best, some of the best years of this country, which I feel like we're getting back now. But yeah, I'm a Canadian.
You know, you mentioned the farm, and you're in both at home here in Canada and in Ireland. And what is that type of isolation or sort of, you know, rural lifestyle? How does that spur the creative juices in perhaps ways a busy city life can't?
Well, I think you hear music, and you hear sort of your connection to source and creation easier. At least I find I do, when there's stillness and there's quiet and you can really hear how you're feeling. And a lot of times music for me isn't about a particular person or about a particular thing. It's just a feeling. And when I'm still and I'm quiet, you feel, and you feel pretty profoundly. And I find when I'm in the city, though it's also possible to create and write, and I've lived in other, you know, I spent a lot of time writing in New York and LA and Nashville, and I've lived in Paris for a while and written there. And so I can definitely do it in the city, but you end up getting a more frenetic energy and a little more edgier. And yeah, just being in the country, I think everything kind of slows down a bit. So I think that's part of it. I probably write slower in the country in terms of a tempo than I would say being in New York City.
Would you say you had a favorite song off of Ghostlight, maybe one that you were proud of the writing process, or just one that you might like to perform on a regular basis?
Well, I'm pretty proud of the record, and I don't think I've ever really put out a record where there wasn't something, you know, because you end up writing a lot of songs, you record a lot of songs, and then you pick the ones you feel best represent you and your art in that moment. So I'm pretty proud of everything on the record itself, but the one I keep sort of pushing towards people, and I keep picking Till the Morning, and it's one that I wrote, again, in one of those moments where it just comes through you and you have this little moment, but everything about that song lined up perfectly. And I recorded it live off the floor, and everything is recorded the exact same time, other than the horns and Hannah George is singing on it. But it's, you know, drums in the room, bass in the room, me in the room, and it's just all that's happening. And, you know, there was no way for it to not sound exactly how it sounds, because the mics are going to pick up everything everywhere. So it just is me doing the thing. And then I happened to be in Toronto, and Hannah happened to be here around the same time, and we're old friends from years back, and we were just talking, like, what are you doing? And she was working on her record, and I was doing overdubs on mine, and it all just happened perfectly. And she came in and sang it with such feeling, and it sounds like Hannah, but also doesn't sound like Hannah, because I think she's was out of her element and in mine. And yeah, I love that song. If you can love your own art, that's the one I feel like it's a pretty perfect representation of what this album is.
Well, the album is Ghost Light. Listeners should check it out. Royal Wood, thanks so much for taking the time today.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
Alrighty, have a good one. Ciao.
And thanks, man.
Don't be afraid. There are two of us sinking. I won't let you drown here alone. We're both on this boat, on a sea of our making, with hearts in our flesh and our bones. To drown you alone here in this place, we'll find ourselves. For tonight, I will love you till the morning comes. For tonight, I will love you till the morning.
Guest is an author and essayist who is also currently the chancellor at Simon Fraser University. She recently edited a collection of writings by her mother, the late author Carol Shields, called Startle and Illuminate. She is Anne Giardini, and here was our conversation. When did you first decide that this was a project worth doing?
Well, I was actually struggling with my own third novel, and I had largely finished it and realized I had not written the book I meant to write. And so was dipping back into my memories of my mother's writing and what she had said to me about writing, trying to remember what she had ever said about this kind of event. And it occurred to me then, this is about 3 years ago, that there's plenty of advice that she had given or spoken about or put in letters that I actually didn't know, and that there might be enough for a full book of writing advice. So I asked my middle son, Nicholas, because he was living in Ottawa at the time and near the archives where my mother's materials are lodged, if he could go and have a look and see what there was.
Your mother and her writing meant so much to so many people here in Canada. But for you, what did she mean as a writer?
That's a great question. Originally, of course, she was just a mother, as you know, one's mother is. But over the years, when she developed as a writer, she published her poetry as a young mother, and then her first novel when she was 40. When I was about 15 or 16. Over the years, we began to talk about the art of writing, and I began to have a double relationship with her, one as a daughter and another as a reader and writer, a fellow writer. So we talked about how books were constructed, how they were put together, what made them work, what made them not work, what made some books take off and others become sleepers, and that kind of thing. So we had an ongoing discussion about that, the art of writing, among many other discussions.
There's one section in the book, I believe it's the first chapter, where she titles it, Writers are Readers First. How important that is to if you wanted to be a writer, to just read everything, read a lot?
Well, something she says in the book is that, you know, she encouraged her writing students to break the rules. But we all know you can't break the rules if you don't know what they are. And it's always interesting, for example, to look at the early paintings by Picasso, say, and they were relatively conventional. He knew how to draw people that look like people and guitars that look like guitars. He didn't paint the way he did because he didn't know how to do it. He learned the vernacular, and then he broke the rules. And so unless you're a reader and sort of an ongoing reader and plugged in a way, how do you know what you're writing relates to the other ideas and books that are out there in the world?
When you first told your mother that you wanted to be a writer, do you remember what her reaction was?
I remember very clearly when I was about 10, and I asserted that not only would I be a writer, but I would only ever write for children, because I thought books for adults sounded very dull. And I think she said something, you know, like that might change over time. And I, having a flair for the dramatic, climbed up onto the kitchen table and announced to the world that I would never write a book for adults, only for children. So I remember that pretty clearly. She was encouraging, and also she encouraged me to think about the endeavor a little more broadly than I was thinking about it at age 10.
Of course, your mother has won a Pulitzer Prize. For the Stone Diaries. Growing up with her, did that have any impact on you? Did you understand what that meant?
Well, she didn't win a Pulitzer till I was a grown-up. Her first novel, however, won awards, the one she published at age 40, so I was about 15 then. And she won Governor General's awards and other awards sort of on her way along the path to the Pulitzer and the Orange Prize and many others. And yes, I think we did, all of us, there were five kids, I think we did pay attention. We went to the award ceremonies, we saw the honors being given and the attention paid, and that entered into how we saw her. But I have to say, that was the least of it, in the sense that what really, I think, interested me, at least, was the many friendships she kept up and the ongoing conversations she had with readers and with writers. And so that was much more part of our daily life. So, you know, for example, she might be on the telephone with Alice Munro, which impressed us mightily, or other writers and publishers and people that had ideas were in and out of the house. And so that was, the awards were nice, but they were few and far between, in the sense that even if you win lots of them, you're still not going to get them daily. it was more the daily life with a writer that I think made an impression on all of us.
One of the questions that this book asks is, you know, how is a writer to know when a work is done? And a lot of writers I've talked to in the past explain that, you know, the work, whether it's a piece of poetry or a short story, will kind of dictate its own ending. Do you agree with that sentiment? Is there a way for you to tell, okay, this piece is done, I'm going to set it aside for now?
I think that's right. I think there's a point at which you're just gilding the lily, that you've said what you have to say, and you're just fiddling with it now. And so you enter into the editing phase where you're polishing and mending holes and, darning it, or as Tyler says, you're adding the coat of varnish, but it's a finished work, and you have nothing left to say on this topic in this piece of work. So there's people like Carl Ove Nosgaard, who write 7 volumes or however many he did. So that's an ongoing story. But even he finally came to an end, and he had nothing left to say on the topic. And so if you feel like you've entered into the varnishing or gilding stage, you're probably done.
We mentioned at the top that you've written 2 novels yourself, The Statute About Happiness and Advice for Italian Boys. How would you describe your own writing process?
Well, I start with an idea, always, a theme or a topic that I want to address, and it's one that I want to know more about. So my first book was about happiness and unhappiness, and I wanted to understand what unhappiness was. And my second book was about the getting and giving of advice. And my third book, which I have to say I don't know that will ever see the light of day, but was about death. And I work with my characters and the situations they're in. I work through to an understanding of the topic that interests me. And I use characters and dialogue and plot to work through that issue. So the book I just started, for example, is about the maternal gaze, the consuming maternal gaze, the way we, in effect, consume our children. Not in effect, but not literally, hopefully. And so by working through a novel, I come to a resolution, an understanding of the issue. And hopefully the reader does too.
What makes a good story for you?
That keeping the buoyancy of the sentences, buoyancy. So there's always a active lightness to what's being said. And that wonderful, wonderful phrase, a page turner, that you want to page the turn, you want to turn the page, sorry, you want to know what happens next. And so a little bit of misdirection, I think, is wonderful, so you don't feel as though you already know what's going to be over the page. But it's the wanting to know what happens next. You know, when kids listen to a story and they lean forward avidly and they say, and then, and it's that and then, I think, that a good writer delivers to her readers.
It's interesting. I was reading the press release here, and there was just a couple of words that described Startle and Illuminate as a necessary reference for writers. So do you think that this book then is sort of a how-to for writers?
I think it's that in part, yes. And also I might say a why-to. You know, why write? And who can write? So maybe it's, you know, how is just one of the questions we have to ask ourselves, the who, what, where, when, why. I think it covers the who, what, where, when, why, who can write, when to write, why to write, and then a number of strategies for writers. I wouldn't say it's an elementary text. A student who read it in draft said it's more of a sophomore writing book than a freshman writing book, and I think that's astute. It assumes not that you've already written, but that you've already thought at least deeply about writing and what writing is. And so I think it takes you a bit deeper. Some of the advice anybody can use, such as how to move your characters around in space and time, that's, you know, anybody can use that. but some of it goes deeper into the questions, the fundamental questions about what kind of stories we want to hear and why we might want to hear them or need to hear them.
So on that note, can we teach people to be a writer, or do you think a writer has to have some semblance of skill already?
I think it's possible for a very naive person to write a remarkable book. I think that is possible. I think some of the biblical stories fall probably into that rubric, and they're powerful stories. You don't need to understand Latin or have traveled widely to be a strong writer. But then there's a line in this book where my mother says, I think you can teach people to write better, but what you can't teach really is how to have better ideas. So someone that's got some command of the language and an idea is better off than someone with no good ideas and an excellent command of language. So I think what is harder to teach is getting good ideas. What's easier to teach is better able to accomplish the work that a writer has to do on the page.
So what do you think your mother's legacy is or will be?
Well, she wrote some books that are returned to over and over again and widely taught in syllabuses in many countries because of what they do and did to the art of writing. She's what might be called a writer's writer in the sense that writers are very interested in how she wrestled with ideas and form and narrative. But at the same time, her books are very readable and approachable and not daunting and not frightening. So that's a rare trick, really, to be a writer's writer and also have that lightness that I spoke of earlier in sentence and on the page that appeals immensely to a reader that doesn't concern himself or herself overly much with the architecture of the work, but more with the simple enjoyment of the story and the situations and the characters.
And my final question quickly is, how did you get Jane Urquhart involved? I've had a chance to speak with her as well. She's another remarkable writer of ours.
Oh, she's amazing, yes. Well, she had known my mother, and I've run into her over the years various places. And we asked her, I asked her, and she was she has another large project, a very exciting one she's working on, which is putting together a book of 50 objects that represent Canada for Canada's 150th birthday next year. So she's very busy, but she just made time for this and room for this, and I know why. One is that she really, I think she was the perfect person to write the foreword, and I think she knew that. But also she just loved my mother, and it was mutual. My mother just loved her. So it was important to have the foreword written by someone that got it, so to speak. And it was the icing on the cake, to use a terrible cliche, to get have a writer as accomplished as Jane Urquhart, but also as generous-hearted and who knew my mother in the sense that we knew her as a person and a beloved writer.
Well, the book is Startle and Illuminate, Carol Shields on Writing. It's available now. Anne Giardini, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. This has been fun.
All right, ciao. That was Anne Giardini. Be sure to tune in Wednesday when I start my coverage of the Vancouver International Film Festival with great Canadian director Bruce MacDonald, as well as the cast and crew of The Unseen. I'm going to take you up with one more song by Royal Wood. This is To Forgive. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Like the stone I placed inside my heart for one. For I see now how the glory can await. For the patient man who holds the hands of fate. If to forget is to forget, maybe love isn't over yet. Well, let's put away the blind. spell. And remember, heaven waits instead of hell. I can see the future where the curtain's drawn. In each other's eyes before the coming dawn. Forget, maybe love isn't over yet. All the ways that we've followed, we were trying to do our best. Let's remember this moment and forget about the rest. All the ways that we've followed, we were trying to do our best. Let's remember. Forgive is to forget. Maybe love isn't over yet.